Okay. Well, last week we were talking about husbands and wives and money. And this week we want, our topic is contentment with money. How many of you know of or have eaten at the Gap Diner? Anybody know the Gap Diner? Oh, a couple of you do. Oh, well, now they're finally admitting it. No one would admit it. Okay. Yeah. So look at this. I'm surprised so many people do know about the Gap Diner. So it's down there in eastern Lancaster County at the intersection of Route 30 and Route 41. And a lot of people know about the Gap Diner because it was, or used to be, a required stop on your way to beach vacations. You would stop there and eat breakfast before you went to the Jersey or the Maryland or Delaware beaches for vacation. Now, I think the place has fallen into a little bit of disrepair, and I don't know that it has quite the reputation it used to, but the parking lot there used to be really full. And when I first started for work in Penn State in the College of Ag, and I was called to go to a farm to help the farmer with an issue, and I was so young and inexperienced that sometimes I would call up to Penn State and have one of their extension professors come out to help me to diagnose what was going on the farm, because I didn't have very much experience. And so it was always convenient because everybody knew where the Gap Diner was at that intersection. I'd say, I'll meet you in the parking lot of the Gap Diner. And so there I was. I'd be sitting there with my jeans and work boots on a hot late June day, waiting for this guy to come from Penn State so we could go out and walk through manure. And here was all these people coming out of the Gap Diner in their shorts and flip-flops and getting in their SUVs that had their beach chairs and beach umbrellas strapped on top. And they were going to vacation. And somehow that made me discontent. I was thinking, like, man, I got to go slog through work today and these people are going to the beach. And not that the beach is necessarily my favorite location, but just the idea of not having to work, you know, for a week. And it was making me discontent. So I decided that I needed to meet these guys from Penn State at on down Route 41 in the parking lot of a hardware store so that I wouldn't be tempted to be discontent about my circumstances. Well, it does seem to be easy to be discontent in our age, which in America, which seems to have limitless possibilities. I mean, a generation ago, when fall came, when summer ended and fall came, you bought a pumpkin to sit on the porch and you bought a mum to sit on the porch and, hey, it's fall. But now, to celebrate fall, you can go to Sheetz and get a pumpkin spice latte. It's required that you buy a pumpkin spice Yankee candle so that your house smells good, and you can buy pumpkin spice donut holes. I mean, you know, the possibilities are just endless. I don't know where all this pumpkin spice stuff came from, but it drives me nuts, you know. You have more opportunity to spend money on more stuff, and the marketers know that, even from just a generation ago. So, boy, it's easy to get into this mindset of being discontented. And yet, as Christians living in this world, we're supposed to be content in all circumstances. There's two passages in the New Testament that are fairly well known and familiar that talk about contentment. Anybody know what they are? Okay, well, the first one You guys obviously did not have your pumpkin spice caffeinated coffee this morning because you're not really tracking here with me yet. So let's hope this gets with it. All right. 1 Timothy 6, 6. Go ahead and turn there if you would. Once you turn there, you'll recognize the verse. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, we can take nothing out of it. If we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Okay, so in the summer, I think Doran talked about this on a Wednesday night. Godliness with contentment. And I believe he taught very well that godliness is right thinking, and contentment is right living. And that you can't have contentment, you can't have right living if you don't have right thinking. And so our process for our lesson today is to talk about what that means to have this right thinking, because that's the root of where contentment begins. Anybody know the other New Testament passage that talks about contentment? Okay, well, that you might want to turn there and just look at that. Philippians 4:12. Actually, we can start in verse 11, I guess, 11 and 12. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Okay? Again, that section of scripture talks real clearly about it's the right thinking that leads to right living. So, to really dig into this, we're actually going to go back to this old dusty book of Ecclesiastes. If I asked you to summarize the message or the book of Ecclesiastes, what would you say? Meaningless. Okay, yes. That word is repeated ad nauseum in the book, that's right. But what's the message? Life is meaningless without. All of life is meaningless without God. If you don't have God and have a proper view of who God is and who you are, all of life is meaningless. And that theme is started in chapter 2, verse 24 through 26. Chapter 2, verse 24 to 26. And this theme is repeated several times, but here's the first time it's repeated. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without God, who can eat or find enjoyment? Remember the theme of Ecclesiastes? Life is meaningless without God. So, right here in the end of verse 24, he says it. This too I see is from the hand of God. Verse 25, for without him, meaning God, who can eat or find enjoyment? Verse 26, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Now, this theme in Ecclesiastes is repeated again in chapter 5, if you want to turn over there. In chapter 5, Ecclesiastes is where we're going to spend the rest of our time in the lesson today. So, chapter 5, verse 18 to 20, repeats the same theme in Ecclesiastes. Then I realized that it's good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Moreover, when God does give any man wealth and possessions, and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift from God. This man seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. Okay. So this seems like a fairly simple recipe to enjoy life. And one of the definitions of being discontent is not enjoying life, right? Not being happy. So here in chapter 5, verse 18 to 20, the writer of Ecclesiastes says, hey, here's a recipe for enjoying life. Accept your lot, happy in your work, have enough to eat and drink, happy in your toilsome labor. How many of you are happy in your toilsome labor? Okay, we have one person who is content. Happy in their work. Good. Okay. Some of us don't have toilsome jobs every day, but there may be portions of our job at times that are toilsome or we don't look forward to it. Okay? Happy in your work. Without God, this is the message of Ecclesiastes, that without God, life is meaningless and has no purpose. It simply is a frustrating exercise and then you die. But with God, all of life is to be enjoyed. And you have the satisfaction of resting in God's provision. And there's a huge gulf between those two attitudes. Okay. So let's start in verse 8 and 9 of this chapter 5. And we want to work down through this a little bit. And as we begin this conversation about contentment, what are the things that are most likely to make you discontent? All right, let me rephrase it. What are the things that are most likely to make your neighbor discontent? Yes. Pardon me? Okay. All right. So we are comparing our circumstances to others. So there's a sense of jealousy and greed there. Okay. What else makes us discontent? Okay. A lack of gratitude. okay? And we've talked about this before, that we as Americans have this outsized sense of entitlement. About life. Okay, anything else? You can drive a lot through those. Those are pretty big. Yes. Being resentful. Okay. And oftentimes, would you say, Cheryl, that that comes from comparing? Not necessarily? Okay. All right. Being resentful. Okay. A lot of these are sort of a continuum. But yeah, they lead to discontentment. And all of this ends up being, as we say, wrong thinking. Okay? Wrong thinking, which leads to wrong living. So let's look at what Ecclesiastes says, starting in verse 8 of chapter 5. If you see the poor oppressed in a district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things, for one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. That seems a little convoluted. What do those verses mean? It means that there is corruption among political systems and among leaders. And leaders who should be out to maintain justice and peace and security and take care of their people instead are doing what? Trying to get as much money as they can. And the guy who's the district official who is trying to get as much money as he can, he takes your money, and then the guy above him takes his money. And it's all a big system. Okay? Now, these are the kind of verses that seem so obscure, but give me great faith in the Bible. You know why? Things haven't changed. Human beings haven't changed. People are still sinful. And so you read something that's written thousands of years ago, and the first thing you read, you go, what is he saying? And then when you realize what he's saying, you think, yeah, Lord, it's just like that today. Okay? Speaking of that, this is a totally complete rabbit trail off the topic. But have you guys ever heard of this term? This is a fancy term. Predatory financing. This cracks me up. This is the new term. This is the new term for piracy. Predatory financing is now the new term for financing. Why is this in the news? Because this is exactly what this crazy outfit, ISIS, does. They conquer territory, they move into a town, they blow up the bank, and they take all the money out of the bank. They kidnap people, and they get a ransom. You know, they don't do anything to build an economy or to have anything left after they're done. They simply are financing their operations in a very predatory and non-sustainable way. And it's no different, really, than what the world has seen from Blackbeard and the pirates from 300 years ago. Okay, it's the same thing. But they have this fancy term for it now, predatory financing. It cracks me up. But anyhow, in a way, these verses in 8 and 9 are kind of talking about predatory financing. All right. Now, we complain about our leaders taking bribes and being affected by lobbyists and not making the right decisions. And that's true, that happens. But certainly we do need to be thankful because our leaders are not involved in shades of predatory financing quite as bad as many places in the world. the point here is that if you have riches, or if you're trying to get riches, one of the ways they disappear is through corruption and corrupt systems in the world. Okay? All right, let's go on to verse 10. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. Wow, is that well said or what? Do you believe that? Do you know that people come to mind that you think of when you look at that verse? Is there a certain level, is there a certain dollar level associated with verse 10? Is it only people who already have $2.5 million and want to get to $3 million? Is that the only people that... No. Okay. You could have $10,000 to your name and be verse 10. It gets back to thinking again. Okay? Really interesting. Verse 11. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer, verse 12, is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. What's verse 11 and 12 saying to us? I got nothing to worry about because I got nothing. Yeah, that's right. Now, is this how the world, verse 11 and 12, is this how the world thinks? I mean, this is what this is, but this, what we're told though is what's the mindset of a rich person? What's the stereotype the world tells us about a rich person? Carefree. How is that told to us? Why are they carefree? They can play all day. They can go on vacations. Best of everything, they have a new car, so they're not worried about this threadbare tires blowing out on us going down the road, okay? I mean, it sounds pretty cool to be rich. Sounds like that's something I'd like. But it's interesting what the writer of Ecclesiastes says. No. The life of a rich person is not the life of ease. The life of a rich person is one that's consumed with worry. Okay? As goods increase, so do those who consume them. As a person becomes richer, there's more people wanting to get their money. Okay. The abundance of the rich man permits him no sleep. Man, that's an interesting phrase. And that's true. The more you have, the more you worry. Increased wealth means increased anxiety and vigilance. The world tells us that increased wealth equals increased enjoyment. That's not true. Okay? You know, you go to a vacation spot somewhere and you see all these people who at least on the outside look like they have lots of money. They're driving very high-end vehicles. They're potentially living, not just renting a place, but they're living in a home in this vacation area with extremely high costs of living. You see the kind of clothes they wear and so on, and the kind of weird expensive dogs they walk on the street, and, you know, not the mutts we have in Perry County. And you say, holy cow, boy, that really looks, this looks like, that's really enjoyment. Okay? But the Bible says no, that kind of lifestyle doesn't lead to enjoyment. It leads to increased anxiety and vigilance to the point where you lose sleep. Okay, verse 13 and 14. I have seen a grievous evil. And that word grievous evil can be interpreted as a depressing misfortune or a sickly disaster. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm or to the sickness of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there's nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb. As he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. This is a grievous evil or a depressing misfortune. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain since he toils for the wind? And verse 17 is just one of these incredible verses in the Bible that, oh, just incredible. All his days he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. That's the New International Version. The New American Standard says, all his days he eats in vexation, sickness, and anger. And that word affliction or sickness, that middle word, actually has the indication of a psychological disease or a mental sickness. Now, how many of you have ever known someone who has been discontent in their life and always grabbing for the next dollar? And that's what life is about. And how many of those people have you known when they've gotten to be very old? And what's their life like? Do you know anybody like that? I have. What's their life been like? Miserable. Yeah, that's a good word to say it. Mm-hmm. And look at verse 17. Again, this is why, you know, you have faith in the Bible, because it so accurately describes the human condition. Look at that. All his days he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. That's the end of someone who is discontent all his days, constantly striving for the next dollar. In the end, it's this picture of this withered up, bitter person eating alone in darkness, because you wouldn't want to light a candle and spend money, with a mental sickness. I've known people like that. I don't know if you have. They are miserable, ugly people. That's the ultimate end of being discontent. The ultimate end of living life not in the satisfaction of what God has blessed you with, but constantly striving for more of this fleeting stuff that we call riches and possessions. This is a really powerful chapter, this verse 5 of Ecclesiastes. I love to read it. And you know why? Because it helps you here. Because all of our waking hours, we are told a message that is exactly opposite of what Ecclesiastes 5 is telling us. So, man, Christian, once in a while, you better go back to Ecclesiastes 5 and get our head on straight. with right thinking. Okay? Comments or questions so far? Yeah, this does not mean, right. This does not mean that you should sell everything you have, Bob. Well, no, I know you're thinking about it, you know. Sell your house, sell everything, and wander the road, you know, okay? Yeah, this is all. Now, Bob, you're bringing up really interesting points about how we look at our business. And am I saying here that we shouldn't strive to make money, or that we shouldn't really care about our work? That it's okay if we're just average employees? That I shouldn't be trying to work hard to get a pay increase at my job? Is that the message here? No, that's not what I'm saying. So you have to walk this line really carefully. I mean, if we're supposed to be content with what God gives us, then why do we even work? Why not just sit around and wait for something to fall in our laps? Why would we strive to work every day? Why get up? Okay. Yeah, and that's the real balancing act. We work because of a verse in Genesis. Turn back to Genesis 2:15. Genesis 2:15 may seem an obscure verse to motivate us to work, but anytime you read any of the Puritan writers, this was really key in their thinking. From this verse comes all these concepts about man having dominion over the earth. Okay? The Lord God took the man, the first man, Adam, and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Okay? It's from that verse that all the rest of our work stems from. Okay? And why we are to be found at work and doing what God leads us to do. So the idea of being content with what we have does not mean that we can be lazy and not work. Because God has wired us to do that, to find satisfaction in our work and to provide for ourselves. And when you get to the New Testament and you read Paul's writings, often Paul refers to the fact about work being important and how he has provided for himself. So contentment doesn't mean we don't work. Contentment doesn't mean we don't try to run a successful business. And especially business people have a really extra challenge, because there is always something that you could use in your business that either needs to be replaced, or if you had it, it would make you more efficient and you could do more work and make more money. every businessman always has something in front of them that ought to be purchased, okay, to help their business. And so it does, especially in business, it does become really important to maintain a right thinking. That, as Jolene said, that's kind of all held in balance. That God is primary in that. And when you're a businessman and so involved in your business and your family's livelihood and your employees are depending on you, it's really hard at times not to make that, I need a new truck, or I need this new tool, or I need this new software to keep track of my payroll. All of those things can really make you discontent, even in your business, much less just your family business or your family checking account. Okay. But good question. Any other comments or questions? Okay, so after this miserable picture that the writer of Ecclesiastes paints in verse 17, here's a picture he paints of the end of life of someone who has spent his days in complete discontentedness. Then the writer returns to verse 18, 19, and 20 about what a picture of contentedness looks like. So you have this stark contrast between verse 17 that we just looked at and verse 18 through 20 that we looked at when we started this lesson. Someone who accepts their lot in life, someone who is happy in their work, someone who is occupied with gladness of heart. Man, that's the kind of person I want to be, and I'm not always that kind of person. I'm not always having gladness of heart with where God has put me. I do have times of discontentedness. Okay? I do get distracted with the world and with riches. And distracted with that lie that if I had more riches, I'd be happier. Okay? I think we all are there at times. And when you are, I would encourage you to go back to Ecclesiastes 5 and just read it. So, let's look in summary of what Ecclesiastes 5 tells us about riches so that we have the right thinking about this. In verse 12, it tells us that riches bring anxiety. In verse 13, it tells us that riches brings harm or pain. In verse 14, it tells us that riches can be lost through bad circumstances. In verse 15, it reminds us that riches are lost how? In verse 15. Death. Okay. Yes. Death. Riches are lost in death. And in verse 17, it tells us that riches cause or produce fear, okay, and vexation. Wow, quite a list from Ecclesiastes 5. If God blesses you with riches, then as was already said here, you take them and be the best steward of them you can. but it never changes your mindset. It should never change your mindset. Now look at verse 19. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy, this is a gift of God. Guess what? All of you here are in verse 19. We were talking about comparing ourselves to others. Well, we always want to compare ourselves to somebody who has more possessions. But every single one of us in this room, when we are compare ourselves to the majority of families in the world, we are verse 19 on steroids. When God has given any man wealth and possessions, compared to the rest of the world, he has given all of you much wealth and possessions. So all of you are verse 19. Okay? All of you. When God gives any man wealth and possessions, that's every single one of you sitting here, and enables him to enjoy them, that's every one of you sitting here. You're sitting in America where you're able to enjoy your wealth and possessions. We're not so corrupt that when we leave church down here at the stop sign, we get stopped by a corrupt cop who wants a bribe to let us go. We don't live in that kind of society yet, so we can enjoy our wealth and possessions. From verse 19. To accept his lot, here's our job. Look at verse 19 now. You all have been given wealth and possessions. You've been given the ability to enjoy them. Now, this is your responsibility right here, this phrase. To accept your lot and be happy in your work. This is a gift from God. God's already given you the first part of 19. The rest of verse 19 is your job. And that happens through right thinking. Okay? So, when I get a verse like that, if I'm struggling with discontentment, yeah, I can write out 1 Timothy 6:6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. I can put that on my bathroom mirror when I go to shave in the morning to be reminded of that verse. But I'm more apt to put up this Ecclesiastes 5:19. So that when I'm shaving in the morning and I'm thinking about what I got to do at work that day, I read this verse and I recall that God has given me wealth and possessions and enabled me to enjoy them. And now it's my job to accept my lot and be happy in my work. Okay? That helps me get the right mindset. That helps me to stay content. It's a great verse, Ecclesiastes 5:19. Okay, any final comments or questions? Well, you're just a contented group this morning. The next 2 weeks, we'll be talking about teaching kids about finances. I'm really looking forward to that. It should be a lot of fun. As we talk about the best ways and what we should really be instilling in our children, maybe our grandkids. So we'll do that for the next 2 weeks. And then following that is Missions Conference, Sunday School of the Missions Conference Sunday. We're flying in Charlie and Harley Hannawalt from the SIL Training Center in Dallas. And we'll have a combined adult Sunday school with the junior and senior high as well in here. And they'll be talking about their work with Wycliffe in Indonesia. So we're really looking forward to that. Only 2.5 weeks to the start of Missions Conference. So I just know you're all as excited as I am about that. So make sure you have that on your calendar. Let's close in prayer. Father, you have given us much wealth and possessions, and you've enabled us to enjoy them. And when we read that verse, we think of Christians in Syria and Iraq and places where they're persecuted for their faith and have been pushed from their homes and have lost all because they won't recant your name and faith in you. And Father, when we get a proper perspective on that sort of thing, we just confess to you in shame our discontent about our circumstances. Father, help us to have right thinking so that we might live right and be proper witnesses for you. We do ask for your strength in this matter. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for coming to Sunday school. See you next week.